And as you do endeavor to maintain the open and receptive mind of Zazen. Tonight, I wanted to talk about our tools of practice in this tradition and give a kind of brief overview of the spectrum of traditional formal Zen meditation practices that we use. And to begin with, I also want to talk a little bit about why we practice, the purpose of our practice. And everything we do in the Zendo, everything we do in meditation, in Dokusan, and encounters with a teacher, is in the service of living our lives increasingly awake. What that means is being present to each moment, present to the choice that's available to us in each moment, living in an increasingly choiceful fashion, so that we're acting from our principles, acting from our aspirations. We're being the person we mean to be. We practice in order to support our actualization of the precepts. We practice in order to be able to be choicefully present to actualize the four impossible bodhisattva vows that we do at the end of each evening. And the tools, the formal tools of Zen, are things that help us do that. They help us be present and flexible to be able to make a choice in each moment, rather than just acting from our conditioning, from the kind of accretions of buildup of beliefs and dispositions and the inherited dispositions we get from our family, from our society, from all that. So rather than just acting out those same patterns, those same cyclic patterns that lead to the suffering with which we're all familiar in some way or other, we're able to, the practices of Zen are to enable us to be free amid all that. And I prefer the construction free amid rather than free from, because those things never go away. You never separate yourself from those things entirely. You're present to them, but in a different way. You're free amid them. You're free with them. So, one time, one of my friends asked me what in my whether I regretted anything in my life, and what she had in mind, the thing that she regretted that kind of prompted this question was, I think one time she saw some kind of petty theft be committed, and she didn't say anything about it. But what my response was when she asked me that was, I kind of had this image of me kind of mindlessly tromping through the beautiful gardens of other people's lives, you know, and that was what I regretted. All of the ways in which I had heedlessly and carelessly kind of just failed to be heedful of the beauty, the interconnection, the various ways in which I had inadvertently caused harm. And this is the first principle of Buddhism, ahimsa, non-harming, which isn't what I was espousing, but like in a doctrinal kind of way. But it was just that, like that's what I regret. I regret, you know, kind of those ways, and that's why I practice. I practice so that I can cause as little harm to myself, to others, to the world, as I can. So, I'm going to focus tonight on our practices on pushing, and the practices in list form are counting your breath, following your breath, perhaps being the breath. So the breath practices. There's shikantaza, just sitting, and there's koan practices. Now this isn't a progression. This isn't an ordering from beginning to advance. The beauty of the Zen tradition, as we've kind of received it in our multiple lineages of Boundless Way, is that we have kind of a lot of tools in our toolkit, and we can kind of it's not a one size fits all situation. So koan practice is not more sophisticated than breath practice. And one of my teachers said of breath practice that there's the beginning practice of counting your breath, there's the intermediate practice of counting your breath, and there's the advanced practice of counting your breath. So each is full and complete, but I want to introduce, I want to kind of introduce you to kind of the functioning of all of them. And part of what's valuable in the Zen tradition is the opportunity to be in dialogue about these practices one-on-one with a teacher. And for all of these practices, kind of least for the breath counting practices and more for the other ones, but for all of them, it's really valuable to explore them with a teacher. Koan practice is utterly impossible to do without a teacher, because part of what koan practice is what goes on between teacher and between the people on both sides of the cushion in the interview. And shikantaza, just sitting, is a practice that is very, very, very simple and very subtle, and it's really easy for all of us to kind of subtly shift into telling ourselves a story about just sitting rather than actually engaging in just sitting. Throughout this little overview introduction situation, I don't want to oversell any of the practices. I don't want anybody to come away thinking some practice is a whole lot better than the others. But if in the event that one of these practices piques your interest, bring that up in interview. All of them can be lifetime practices. All of them are very, very rich and fruitful, and all of them can serve as practice, as training, in order to be increasingly free in your life, cause decreasing suffering. So, shikantaza, just sitting. There's kind of two ways in which shikantaza is talked about in the Zen tradition, and like in the modern Zen tradition. One is as something really, really just incredibly difficult that you can't possibly be doing right, and you're almost certainly doing it wrong, and you think you're doing shikantaza, but you're not. And that's kind of the way that I was first introduced to it. And I've never found that real helpful. And yet, shikantaza is very very subtle. And what it essentially is a practice of doing, less and less and less, interfering with the perfection of things exactly as they are, less and less and less. In Shikantaza, the practice is more letting be rather than letting go. Letting go sounds too active, and it puts us in too much of a position of controlling what goes or stays or what happens or doesn't happen. And instead, it's just a practice of letting be. But even that formation, letting be, that letting is entirely too active, because the universe is not asking our permission to be. It is. We are. This moment is. And so it's just being with this. And the practice of Shikantaza, especially, and also all of the other practices, and they're in many ways not separable. But the practice of Shikantaza, especially, is vigilance to all of our striving, all of our inward striving, all of the things we're trying to do with our mind, all of the ways we're trying to make this moment feel, whether we're trying to feel calm or spiritual, or whether we're trying to be focused or grounded, or even trying to be present. All of those things are forms of striving and grasping. And they also, right there in that same grasping gesture, is a gesture of aversion. And so there's a practice of also noticing all of the ways in which we're both deciding that this moment can't be it. This moment can't be enough. Our body and mind, just as it is, can't be Buddha. This very land can't be the Lotus Land. All of the ways in which we're sure that's true. So that aversion arises, this can't be it, I don't want it. And then the delusion arises when we believe those aversive thoughts, when we believe our conclusions, our beliefs about what can and can't be possible. So Shikantaza is a practice of doing less and less and less in a way that leaves you in a very beautiful, rich, comprehensive way with nothing at all. And what's challenging about Shikantaza, and what's valuable to be in a dialogue with a teacher about, is because we're continually finding little things that we wanna like grab onto, you know, little handholds on the sheer cliff that we don't want to let go of, or little edges to stand on, and then you know, holding onto that, we're saying how we're letting go of everything except our idea about what we should be doing here. And so it's sometimes hard to see those on your own. And this is why the teacher in Zen is sometimes compared to a mirror, because the teacher often just points out, see that? You know, this way Shikantaza is actually kind of fun. Humorous. You know, other ways of describing the process of Shikantaza, the practice of Shikantaza, is being intimately present to ourselves, being open-handedly, open-heartedly, broken-heartedly, wounded-heartedly present to ourselves, to this moment. All of those are descriptions of Shikantaza. And another description is, well, of one way of describing breath practices is synchronizing body, breath, and mind. But that's also a form of doing. And so if we're practicing Shikantaza, even trying to do that is too much. Because in fact, body, breath, and mind, there's a way in which, there's an important way in which they're always synchronized. They're always this. Even when one's going over here and one's going over there, that's still the perfect expression of one going over here and one going over there. Sometimes the practices associated, and so with Shikantaza, if wisdom and freedom and compassion are metaphorically getting wet, the practices of Shikantaza are walking slowly through a thick fog. You stay out there long enough, you're going to be thoroughly soaked through. You may not notice it happening, but it is happening nonetheless. Other practices, such as to a certain extent, koan practice is kind of likened to stepping outside in a really strong storm. The rain's coming down really hard, and you're going to really see it happening. But in a way, that completely oversells koan practice. But be wary of that. And this vigilance for striving and aversion, this doing less and less and less, this seeing, this just allowing for the perfection of things as they are, it is also like the it's not a far jump to the practices of the Shin Pure Land school, where not only do they say you don't need to do anything to be Buddha, to be saved by the compassion of the universe, but you can't. There isn't anything in the category of things that you can do with your little calculating, striving mind. All doings are not in the category of things that'll help. Part of the reason for that is because you're already Buddha. Or in the Shin Pure Land expression, because through the functioning of Amida's compassion, through the functioning of the compassionate nature of the universe, you are already saved. Koan practice. The way that I learned, the way that I was first taught, and the way that I think most of the teachers in Boundless Way still teach is that koan practice is something that you may choose to engage in after some amount of getting familiar with usually a breath practice. Apparently, James's teacher, John Tarrant, now will start koan practice with people just in off the street. That's kind of a radical departure for the Zen world, and it's kind of an experiment on his part, and I don't think it's one that we actually run, but I'm interested to know how it's going for John. Koans are kind of the most uniquely Zen tool around. What koans aren't is something meant to shock you out of your whatever dualistic mind. You know, like there's a way that the definition of a koan is kind of, it's been popularized in our culture. Like it even appears on The Simpsons. There's one episode where Lisa asks Bart, "What's the sound of one hand clapping?" Which is a very famous Zen koan invented by Master Hakuin, and Bart says, "Oh, that's easy. It's like this," and it makes some noise with one hand, you know. And she says, "Well, if a tree falls in a forest and no one's around, does it make a sound?" Which isn't the koan, but nonetheless. And then all of a sudden, you know, like Bart's eyes go wide, and he's like in some weird state, you know. And there's a way in which our culture, our kind of
popular understanding is that a koan is something that does that to you. It's not true.
Koans are kind of several different things. It's kind of a heterogeneous collection of things. So there's books of koans. There's koans that are kind of story based. They have characters and dialogue in them and stuff like that. And part of what those are is they're the family history of Zen. And they're Robert Aitken, our great great grandfather in the Dharma, maybe another great, no, just great great. Defines koans as universal particulars. So they're a particular manifestation of a universal principle, a particular functioning of a universal truth. And universal truths are only ever manifest in particular manifestations. There is no like universal truth that you can like have. There's only particulars. And what koans are about is a kind of training in moving between the universal and the particular, moving between the absolute and the relative levels of truths. And there's a way in which koan training as a kind of collective entity, it really is like a kind of drill. It's their practices, their thing, you can't look at any individual koan and, I mean, you can look at it and have some good insights, you know? It can point to something valuable in your life, and that's part of, or in the Buddhist teachings, and that's part of the value of koans. But koan training, as the way it's practiced in the koan lineages of Zen, it involves the hundreds and hundreds of koans, kind of, and the process of going through each of them. Koans are they're valuable in kind of addressing the philosophical questions you may have, or if you have a need for understanding the nature of reality. Now they aren't going to answer your philosophical questions, and they aren't going to tell you the nature of reality. But if you are really plagued by those kinds of questions, koans can address that plague in a way that will be satisfying, perhaps ultimately, and very unsatisfying, perhaps along the way. Koans are, one of my teachers talked about koans as dragon speech. Dragons in Buddhism are great enlightened beings, the keepers of much wisdom. They have a special language that mere humans can't understand. And to hear the masters in the language of the koans, you know, we kind of have a shadowy, dim awareness of what it is. And it's kind of an invitation to go further, to explore it. The practice of doing koans is, in a certain way, it's kind of like learning a foreign language. It's learning a way to relate to and express these absolute and relative truths. And when you're working with koans, what do you actually do with them? And kind of every student wants to know. And we kind of all have to find out for ourselves. There's different ways in which different ways in which it's talked about. One of my teachers, described really just being consumed by the koan, bringing all of your attention. He was very samadhi focused. Samadhi is extreme meditative concentration, single pointedness of mind.
He emphasized that a lot. And it was never anything that I could particularly relate to or bring a great deal of energy to bear on, but he talked about bringing your single-pointedness of attention to that, to your koan. I don't know what that means, and it's never the way I've engaged koan practice. Shoto Harada Roshi, who's a Japanese teacher in the Rinzai lineage and is kind of the teacher's teacher. A lot of American Zen teachers and Japanese Zen teachers, well, fewer Japanese Zen teachers for other reasons, but a lot of Western Zen teachers who are themselves teachers travel to Japan to study with Shoto Harada Roshi and to study koans with him. And the way he describes doing koans, he says, don't think about it at all. Just do your breath practice on the cushion, and then in the 2 seconds right before you go into interview, call it up into mind, and then take it from there. Yet another teacher who emphasizes stilling the mind and quieting the mind, which is not an emphasis that Boundless Weizen has, but she emphasizes stilling the mind and quieting the mind, and then every time your mind moves, you drop the koan in like a depth charge, and then let it go, and then return to your stilling the mind and quieting the mind. We also might then return to our breath practice, or in fact, then return to Shikantaza. So that there's that way in which the koan practices and the Shikantaza and breath practices aren't completely separate. One of my friends was in divinity school at Boston University, which is a Christian divinity school. In one of their Bible study classes, they said, bring your skepticism, ask your questions, don't be afraid to challenge this. The Bible has stood the test of time for however many thousands of years, Old Testament, New Testament, whatever, and it can take your questions, it can take your skepticism, it can take your doubt. And koans are kind of like that. If you're doing koan practice, you don't have to like koans, you don't have to trust koans, you don't have to enjoy koans. It can receive all of that, and that's kind of its strength, is that any amount of doubt that you have, you can bring to it. For some people, For me, part of what was inspiring me to do koan work was my first teacher. He would sit in the Dharma hall and he'd give talks, and it was clear that he understood something that I did not understand, and that was so unacceptable to me that was like a goad for me. But that's just, and that was kind of what I needed at that particular point in my development. But there's ways in which koans bring to bear, they bring into focus all of your ideas about what enlightenment is, about what Zen is, about what koans are, about what a Zen teacher is, about what passing a koan is or should be, about what not passing a koan is or should be. So for some people, not passing a koan is the part that's really a hard challenge. For other people, they pass koans easily, but the problem is that they're passing koans, and they're, what are you doing? You're passing me on this koan. I'm still just me. It's just me with this little mind. And koans are meant to, or they effectively evoke that. And what koan training as a kind of collective entity does is kind of really systematically in a focused way, like, detonate each of your treasured beliefs, each of your ideas about Zen, about Zazen, about practice, about enlightenment, about Zen teachers, about all of that, until one piece, one treasured piece after another, until you're left with, surprise, nothing. It's the same nothing that you are practicing, noticing, and not even that much in Shikantaza. one practice one of my teachers described as, the word she used was devious. Devious. The way they work. So it isn't what it seems to be. And koan, you know, the koan literature is also, you know, a great treasure house of wisdom. And I encourage you all to explore it and think about them and reflect on them and inquire about them. But also understand that that process is wholly separate from koan training as it's actually practiced in the koan lineages of Zen. That's my overview of the things we do in Zen. Does anybody have any questions, or anything you want to share about your own experience of any of these practices? Mm-hmm. So, counting is the practice that we're first introduced with, and it's a practice that I begin every retreat with, and it's a practice that I still do. There are other things to do with breath practice. There might come a point in your practice where actually counting each breath, thinking that number, starts to feel like too much doing. You become proficient at it, but that's a really deceptive word because that implies that there's some that you're not proficient at it in some other state. But it's a kind of additional scaffolding as we kind of build a structure within, what the practice of counting each breath is. It's a way of heightening the contrast between when we're actually practicing zazen and when we're being intimately present to this moment, and when our mind is doing the things that minds do, and then we need to return it to be intimately present with this moment. It's a way of artificially heightening the contrast for that. And as we practice, we start to be able to see those things happening without needing the contrast highlighted. So that's a point at which we might be just following the breath. And an intermediate stage is to just be counting either the inhales or the exhales rather than both. And you could experiment with how that feels, those two different practices. But to let go of the scaffolding, to diminish the heightened contrast still further, is just following the breath. Which is continuing to use the breath as the object of meditation, as the place we're returning our attention to. And Shikantaza is described sometimes as objectless meditation, which is kind of hard to get your head around, kind of necessarily. And the alternative is object-based meditation. So just continuing to use the breath as the object of our meditation, meaning that that's the place we place our attention. And it's a place when our attention wanders, as it does, we return it back to our breath, feeling fully it going in and out, feeling the pause as it changes direction, really kind of intimately and fully feeling the experience of breathing. And so that's following the breath. There's a practice being the breath.
which is kind of the place where breath practice kind of starts to overlay Shikantaza. So it's the same as following the breath, except even less doing, even less moving. And what's interesting about the breath as an object is that we can both, our breathing happens on its own, and when we bring attention to it, then it, a kind of control mechanism kind of engages, or the impulse to engage happens, you know, and then we start to do something with our breath. And so part of the practices of just breathing, or being the breath, or following the breath, is being in that space with attention on the breath before the attention starts to clamp down as actual controlling, actual doing, and just noticing the breathing happening. Yeah, Zen generally, yeah. Zen generally, not just Shikantaza.
Well, sure.
Yeah.
But still, so... And then what we do with that is just...
Yeah.
But would you call that the common practice? Not that it matters, I suppose, if you're...
Well, first I want to talk a little bit about who am I. Dido used to talk about... that being like the ultimate question of Zazen, and you know, and that the focus of your great doubt, who am I? And I didn't even understand the question, and I often was sitting there at Zen Mountain Monastery thinking, am I in the wrong place? That's not actually my question. My question was more like, why does it hurt so much to be me? But that wasn't Dido's question, apparently, and teachers tend to teach, you know, emphasizing their own stuff. That is a honorable and long lineage having practice. That's the way koans are engaged in the Korean Zen tradition. Although not the Sungsan Korean Zen tradition, also in certain ancient, now deceased Chinese Zen traditions. I know nothing about that, and that doesn't fit into what my experience of the devious longitudinal koan training situation is. So the way I understand that is kind of a coincidental use of the word koan. And you're right that those kinds of questions, to me, I would work with those questions in the context of Shikantaza rather than in the context of koan. And if your own question ever clarifies for you, you know, like that, I encourage you to bring that to me or any other teacher and interview, because that's a really rich place to start to work, to start to engage in the immensely liberating and sometimes extremely frustrating experience of the perfection of things as they are. What are your other sub questions? Why 25 minutes and then? So why 25 minutes? On the one hand, no reason whatsoever. Lots of other Zen, American Zen sanghas sit 35 minutes, 45 minutes, 40 minutes. Usually something, you know, usually not less than 25 minutes, and usually not more than like two 25-minute periods together with a bell to wiggle and shift once. And because after that, you've got to address your body somehow. 24 minutes, coincidentally, is in the Tibetan tradition called the Gatika, and it's 1/100th of a day. And so that's kind of the philosophical reason to sit that long. That's kind of cool. But there's nothing magical about it. And how often you should sit. Any question involving should has a whole lot of, you know, belief, you know, a whole lot of stuff going on there. And I don't have an answer for should. Some teachers say you have to. One of my first questions to my first teacher was how much do you practice each day? Because, you know, here we were in the monastery practicing hours and hours, and wanted to know how much do you actually personally sit zazen each day? And I was a pain in the ass. he sat a half hour a day. It's valuable, especially as you're starting to forge a connection to the practice, to sit regularly. Maybe. But also everybody's. I don't practice zazen on a cushion every day. I practice Zen every day. I went through many years of my life in which I also practiced zazen on a cushion every day. And I think that it's valuable at some points. And there's times when I consciously stopped sitting for various reasons. And what the way the Buddha described the Dharma is it's good in the beginning, good in the middle, good in the end. And so it's also good in any dosage. A little bit is good, a medium amount is good, a lot is good. And there's a way in which a little can remain superficial, and a lot can be too much and obsessive. So something that enables you to connect to your practice of Zen, not just your practice of Zazen, and Zazen is a way
to connect to your practice of Zen, to your practice of liberating yourself in each moment, of practicing choicefulness, of practicing harmlessness, of actualizing your vows and your aspirations. And so there's a lot of, it's kind of often presented to sit a little bit in the morning and a little bit in the evening before bed, if that works for you. Also, just because that's a pattern that fits well into people's schedules. I happen to work in a Buddhist workplace, and so we sometimes sit together in the middle of the day. And that works for us. And you can sit for 2 minutes. You can sit for 1 minute. You can sit for 5 minutes or 10, or whatever suits you. And it might change. The thing that I encourage you to do with your practice at home is decide beforehand how long you're going to sit and sit for that long, rather than just sitting until you get jittery and then jittering off the cushion. And if you want to explore this, like particularly about you in the context of your relation to it, then definitely bring that question to an interview. Koan practice will also detonate that belief for you at some point. But in the meantime, enjoy it. Thank you, everyone. So concluded.